Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. With a deeper berth and larger cranes, the Port of Baltimore this summer welcomed its first megaship that had transited the newly expanded Panama Canal. The expansion of the canal took 9 years and about $5.5 billion. It now has a set of wider and deeper locks that allow much bigger ships to pass through. The canal can accommodate ships carrying up to 14,000 containers, almost tripling their previous capacity. An industry report cited by the Wall Street Journal estimates the canal's expansion will boost container traffic to East Coast ports by about 10% over the next 4 years. So how did Baltimore prepare for these larger ships? Are bigger ships expected to bring more jobs to our region? What challenges lie ahead for the port? We want to talk about all of that this hour. And later in the hour, we'll also remember Helen Delick Bentley, former congresswoman and staunch advocate for port improvements. She died August 6th at age 92. James J. White has served as executive director of the Maryland Port Administration since 2007. His second stint, he also headed the port from 1999 to 2005. He oversees the 6 public marine terminals at the Port of Baltimore. The Port of Baltimore ranks first among U.S. ports for handling automobiles and light trucks, farm and construction machinery, imported aluminum, and sugar. Welcome to Midday, Mr. White.
Pleasure.
I'm so glad that you could join us. And listeners, you can join this conversation, too. Do you work at the port? Do you have some questions about how the port operates? Do you think it has a big impact on the Maryland economy and therefore an impact on you, even if you don't work at the port? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. So tell me more about how the port prepared for the expansion of the canal.
Well, we knew that the Panama Canal would provide a great opportunity for us on the East Coast, not only for Maryland, but all the ports along the East Coast, because traditionally all the Asian freight would be discharged on the West Coast and then railed across the country to local consumption in our region. And with the widening of the Panama Canal and the longer set of locks, the bigger ships could come through. So we all started to prepare for that. It came at a really poor time, though, as far as our country was concerned, because we were coming out of the Great Recession. It was 2008, 2009, and we get our capital money from the Transportation Trust Fund. And
of the state, the states.
From the state, through the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Ron. And at that time, we knew the Transportation Trust Fund could not provide us enough funding for the new cranes that would be needed because the cranes aren't tall enough or reach out far enough
for the bigger ships
to work these bigger ships. So there was about $120 million that needed to be invested for us to be ready. We had the 50-foot channel. We didn't have a 50-foot berth, nor did we have the cranes to work it. So it was decided then that we would try to find a third party to come in and help us with the funding of it. And we did. It was Ports America. They came in and they invested $52 million into the berth, probably another $40 to $45 million into the cranes. We sold them all the assets that were existing at Seagirt Marine Terminals. So they also wrote us a check for $140 million. So at this point, before they invest into additional handling equipment, they've got about $250 million invested into Maryland. So they certainly saw an opportunity here. And it's worked out great for us. They've been wonderful partners. And the true meaning of a private-public partnership is present with Ports America today. A lot of the other ports around the country tried to do private-public partnerships, and I thought they were just going to flip them the keys to the terminal and back away from it.
Let me make sure I understand. Who thought who was going to flip the keys and back away?
Well,
I'm not talking about particular names, but are you saying that that private investors expected more control than other ports are willing to give them, or I'm not quite following the point you're making.
The ports that tried, like there was a private-public partnership in Oakland, and the port thought that once they did the private-public partnership, they could walk away from their responsibilities to providing jobs and economic impact. And that failed. Here, we embraced it. We worked with Ports America on the commercial side as well as the operating side to make sure that we're a very efficient port. So it is a true partnership. We meet regularly. We talk about marketing strategy, what type of equipment should be employed. And it's worked. Recently, the Journal of Commerce did an independent study for efficiency of ports around the world. And we were recognized as the most efficient port in the United States. And
so that means you move freight faster with less cost? Define for me what efficiency means.
Efficiency, like trucks, when they come to the terminal. If you look at what's happening in New York and Virginia, they're turning trucks in about 2 hours. Here, for a truck move, and we have single moves and double moves. If a single move would be if a trucker picked up a loaded container, say an imported container, took it out, delivered it, and was bringing back an empty, it's how quickly he dropped off that empty and leave the terminal. That's 30 minutes on average here in Maryland. If you're doing a double move, say that same trucker comes in, drops off that empty, and he wants to pick up another imported load for delivery, that's less than an hour. And compare that to our surrounding ports, it's 2 hours or better.
And so what is it that you do at the Port of Baltimore that makes it that such a quick turnaround?
I think that these systems that Ports America provides to the trucking community is second to none. They have great computer systems for locating the containers. And the ILA, we work very closely with
International Longshoremen's.
International Longshoremen's Association.
And the union.
Yes. And, you know, it's really a combination of everybody working together because although we own the property, we work very closely with Ports America. They're the ones that invest into the equipment, but it's really the labor that is a critical component of how quickly you turn trucks or how quickly you take containers on and off the ships. So we spend a lot of time with them. We embrace them. Even when we had the first big ship here through the Panama Canal, Evergreen executives were here.
Evergreen was the shipping line that owned that first big ship, right?
Correct. And we invited the labor to be with us as our partners. We went out. We had a nice lunch with Evergreen, the longshoremen, management, Ports America. Secretary Ron was there, you know, working the customers as hard as we were. So it was a nice event.
And I'm sure a nice lunch accounts for something. But I'm also curious when you talk about the importance of labor in the efficiency that the port is praised for and that presumably attracts shipping companies. Is there some special training that gets done for with workers at the Port of Baltimore, or what is the secret sauce that in addition to the nice lunches that makes things work so well?
I think we work very well together. We want to grow jobs. The state wants to grow jobs, wants to grow economic impact through the state. Ports America is obviously in it for profits. It's a private company. They're investing here to make profits. They have a lot invested. And the longshoremen know that the East Coast is fiercely competitive when it comes to containerization. If you look to the north of us, you have Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Norfolk. We're in the middle of the Mid-Atlantic here, sitting inland. To the south of us, you have Wilmington, Savannah, Charleston, Miami, Lauderdale. So it's fiercely competitive here on the East Coast.
And on that point, let me ask you, right now, Baltimore is one of just four East Coast ports that are geared up, equipped to take the very big ships coming that can come through the Panama Canal. It's the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, Baltimore, Port of Virginia, and Miami, right?
Miami.
How important was it that you be, because presumably the, you just ticked off a whole bunch of other ports on the East Coast, and presumably they are at some point going to catch up, or most of them are. So how important was it for Baltimore to be among those ready as soon as the canal was started moving those big ships?
Well, it was extremely important for us because we're one of the few ports in the North Atlantic port range that is not at capacity. New York is at capacity today, and Virginia is pretty much at capacity. We're about 60% capacity at Seagirt Marine Terminal for containerization. So we have room to grow. And you can imagine when these big ships come in and discharge, the frequency is less because you have more containers on bigger ships. So you don't have the frequency of calls. And the rule of thumb in the maritime business is on the operating side that if you get these bigger ships coming in, you need 30% more land to handle the same amount of volume because there's bigger loads coming in and out of the marine terminals. And us being at 60% capacity, we can easily handle that. So it was very important for us to be ready, so when those ships did start to come, that we could maintain our efficiencies, both on the truck side as well as the marine side, so that we could accommodate more traffic with the same flow of business as we had before.
So you were at 60% capacity before. Where do you expect to be a year from now?
I would think that we'd probably be about 70% capacity, maybe about another 10%. We could grow this year if we have a very good year.
And how do you see it? Do you have a forecast going beyond a year? I mean, when would the way things are going now? The contracts you have, the agreements with shipping companies that, like for example, you recently signed a 30-year contract with
Wallenius Wilhelmsen.
Yeah. So when you look at all that, is the Port of Baltimore going to be at capacity in a few years?
Well, as the Port of Baltimore is a very diversified port, and we designed it that way. We're number one in automobiles. We're number one in roll-on, roll-off cargo, which is farm equipment, machinery, construction machinery. Containerized, we probably rank around 13th in the country. And imported forest products, we're number one. So when you look at capacity, each of those cargo types require different types of environments for operating within. You know, forest products will go into warehouses. Automobiles will flow into storage areas in different terminals. And containers are all consolidated at Seagirt Marine Terminal. We do probably 99% of our containers at Seagirt Marine Terminal. So we have room to growth. On the forecast for the future is that the capacity at Seagirt will be able to maintain growing our business for about another 8 to 10 years. At that point, we will need another marine terminal to handle additional containers.
Okay, on that pregnant thought, we need to take a quick break. I want to ask you kind of what the outlook is for that. I want to ask you what the relationship is with Sparrows Point. I want to ask you what any of this means for jobs in the Baltimore region. As I said, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about the Port of Baltimore with James White. You can join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780. Do you work at the port? Have you taken a cruise out of the port? What about that aspect of the port? You can call us or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Combining both the public and private terminals, the Port of Baltimore handled more than 30 million tons of international cargo last year, valued at $50 billion. From paper to sugar to construction equipment, the Port of Baltimore sees a wide variety of cargo each day. With me to talk about the port is James White, Executive Director of the Maryland Port Administration. And we're taking your calls at 410-662-8780, your emails at midday@wypr.org. So you laid out for us that the port has some capacity to grow and that you do expect its business to grow. What do you see that meaning for jobs and what kind of jobs?
Well, today the port is responsible for about 17,000 direct jobs. If you add in the induced and indirect jobs, it's about 50,000.
So, and give me an example of what you mean by an induced or indirect job.
Those are jobs, let's say that a direct employer that's has a direct job. An indirect job would be that business that, say the truck driver, right, that's employed, that comes into the marine terminal, that business that he works for has business spending. So that business
spending...
So
you're counting the truck driver as a direct job.
Yes.
But you're saying that because when his employer or her employer spends money for office equipment, for rents office space, et cetera, that's an indirect job that
yes.
the port can take some
exactly.
credit for. And
yes.
so if you look at that huge ripple effect, you count how many jobs, how much of an impact on Maryland's
about
economy?
50,000 jobs combined with the direct, induced, and indirect jobs.
And that's the way you see it now. Do you have an estimate of what the expansion of the Panama Canal will do to that picture? How much bigger do you think the footprint will be?
We really don't measure that in the out years, but there is one more other component to the job base, and that's the related jobs. And that would be jobs that are like warehouse jobs that necessarily aren't totally dependent on a port, like a forklift driver in a warehouse doing transshipment cargo. If you add that in, it's up to 130,000 jobs.
So one would expect it to those numbers to grow because you're going to be doing more business at the port?
Yes.
We've got a couple of callers who don't see the trucks moving as fast as you do. Chuck has called us from Baltimore. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great. Your question?
My question was if they had any plans on moving the trucks in and out of the port any faster. You're talking about, you know, bringing more freight into the, you know, into Seaguard, and just wondering if you have any plans on getting them out any faster, hiring more help. I'm in and out of Baltimore and Seaguard, you know, all day long, and we routinely wait 1 hour to three and a half hours to get one load out of the port. And you're talking about bringing in a whole lot more freight, and they can't seem to get it out now. So what are you going to do when you've got, you know, a lot more than you have now?
Chuck, thanks for the question. And I should say Joel has also called us. He says he's a driver who comes in daily, takes 2 or 3 hours to get in and out. What would you say to Chuck and to Joel?
I would say it's the exception rather than the rule. Obviously, on certain days, not everything runs perfect. But on a running average, we turn trucks at Seaguard single moves in 30 minutes and double moves in less than an hour.
But I have the impression that you're talking about, is there a queue to get, do trucks wait to get to the point where you start measuring that half hour, that hour?
Yes, there is.
And is there any plan to address that waiting time to get into the port?
We are looking at opening up another gate facility. Maybe it will handle just empty returns and we'll put loads through the existing terminal. It's all being planned right now for future growth. We don't know exactly what we're going to do today, but we are planning for future growth and how we can handle that to maintain or improve upon our truck turn times.
I suspect Joel and Chuck will both be watching you. Chuck and Joel, thanks for the call. I want to pick up on you said that at some point in a measurable number of years, you expect to need a new terminal.
Correct.
Where would that be?
We've been working with Sparrows Point, Trade Point Atlantic. I've talked to their CEO there, Michael Moore. He has it on his radar screen, and hopefully they'll be able to
just this week we learned that Under Armour is opening a big distribution center at Sparrows Point. They expect to have 1,000 workers there. The Baltimore Sun reported that Trade Point, which is the trade name for the company that is the business that is redeveloping Sparrows Point. That they were not interested in selling a portion of land to the Port Administration for storing dredge materials, and that the port had been interested in buying an automotive roll-on, roll-off terminal, but that land ended up being sold to a California-based auto importer. It doesn't sound like TradePoint is... as an outsider to me, I don't claim any inside knowledge, but it doesn't sound like TradePoint is sort of saving space for port expansion. Do I have the wrong impression?
I think you do.
Okay. Tell me why. Tell me how.
I think by attracting Under Armour, we help each other, because Under Armour traditionally did not use the Port of Baltimore for discharging its imported containers. They were trucked across the country. They were being discharged on the West Coast, as I said earlier. This creates an opportunity for us and an incentive, I think, for Under Armour to move more freight directly through our port. It's closer. You're not trucking it across the country. It's being landed at your doorstep. And I think TradePoint Atlantic, as well as Mike Gill, in
Secretary of Commerce,
did a terrific job in convincing Under Armour this was the right place to be. I think TradePoint Atlantic stepped to the plate, and that's going to help us. And we continue to talk about automobiles. I don't think they sold any property over there. I think they are leasing land to an auto processor there in hopes of attracting and growing our automobile business.
Isaac has called us. Isaac, welcome to Midday.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I'm the director of research at Mahan Reichel Associates. We're a landscape architecture, urban and urban design firm based in Baltimore. And we actually had the pleasure of working with the Baltimore Museum of Industry and the Port of Baltimore Alliance this summer to do a design research project with the professor from Cornell University. And I really just want to add a little bit to the conversation, as the port is obviously a major economic engine, but more than simply being an economic engine, it's one of, I think, the most important kind of cultural landscapes we have as a city. And you think about what makes Baltimore a great city, you have to understand it first and foremost as a port city, and its trajectory in terms of its historical development growth as a city, as well as an ecological engine in terms of the amount of wetlands that are created and the amount of earth that's moved by the port to maintain shipping channels, and the greening and mitigation efforts that the port is doing. So the port is more than just an economic engine, and I think expanding the conversation about the port to include the cultural and ecological aspects of the port is important in understanding its role and its importance here in the city.
Isaac, I appreciate the call. Thank you for making that point. Is there something in particular you'd like to build on what Isaac said?
Well, he's 100% right. We are the biggest wetland creator in the state of Maryland.
Yeah, I read that. Explain that to me.
Well,
how does that work?
We create these disposal sites. You know, one that we're very proud of working with the Army Corps of Engineers is we're restoring an island that has washed away over decades, Poplar Island. We're restoring it to its natural configuration, what it was a century ago. And in doing so, we're improving the environment. We're creating all these wetlands there. If you go out there and look at it, it's incredible what's out there. You see bald eagles, you see a turtle that are being hatched right along the shoreline, a lot of grasses, and it helps us with maintaining the channel. So we're very proud of that. We bring in the communities when we're working on projects like this. We developed Masonville into a dredge disposal site. It was an old shipbreaking facility, very bad on the environment side. We went in, we cleaned it up. We opened up ramps for the community to go down and, canoe and picnic. And there's also an educational center there that we built where we invite schools in and they see what we've done there. And it's he's 100% right. We do add a lot to the community besides jobs and economic impact.
That is James White, Executive Director of the Maryland Port Administration, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the port, it's the likelihood of its business expanding, and other activities. You can join the conversation with a phone call to 410-662-8780 or an email to midday@wypr.org. When we're talking about the new or the expanded cargo that's coming into the port, it leads me to wonder about the bottleneck that currently exists. The Howard Street Tunnel, which isn't tall enough to accept double-stacked containers, as a lot of trains can carry, but can't carry them in Baltimore. How much of a limitation on the port is the Howard Street Tunnel?
The Howard Street Tunnel has been a very big limitation and challenge for us in trying to attract more containers moving through here. We do very well because we have such a huge population here. It's the third largest consumer group in the country. So for local consumption, the containers come direct. They go out by truck. But if you look at discretionary cargo, cargo that can move over any port because of their rail systems, say New York, it can move over Philadelphia, Virginia, or Maryland, we don't do well because we don't have double stack capability. And the railroads have to put twice the equipment here and to move the same amount of freight. If you can imagine a rail car that comes in with one container on it, or if it's stacked too high, you need half the amount of rail cars to handle the same amount of freight. So we become expensive on the rail side of it. So normally that freight moves over New York or Virginia. If we can get double stack, which we will, that will put us back in the ballgame. And
Maryland was trying to get $155 million from the federal government to help reconfigure the tunnel, but the feds turned that down.
That's correct. We were coming up with $145 million to invest into it, the CSX $145, and we asked the federal government for $155. Unfortunately, that was fast lane money. We didn't get it. That was the first round of it. There will be another opportunity for us later this year. We're sitting down with the CSX next week and seeing how we can improve our request.
I was going to say, what is it that you think would be more persuasive to get the federal money that you're hoping to make that possible?
Actually, I think that we had a terrific project going in. I think that we hit every question there with an excellent response. We were all devastated when we didn't get it because we thought the project and the way they wanted to spend this money was aligned perfectly. I even went right past it. I thought we were going to get the money, and I was thinking about how we can streamline the permitting process, reaching out to the mayor and the city council to help us with that. And when it came back that we didn't get the money, I think everybody was really surprised and devastated by it. I can tell you this, that the state is behind it. The very first time I met with Governor Hogan, the first question he asked me is, how are we going to address the Howard Street Tunnel? It's good for business. You know, I want to do something about it. And he charged me with moving forward, coming up with a solution for it. He knows how great it would be for our port. And when we first started to sit down with the CSX, we knew someone was going to have to write a big check from the state, $145 million. I went to Secretary Ron. He said, go. So we sat down with the CSX. Combined, we put together an application, but unfortunately,
and am I right that the engineering plans are that that work could be done inside the tunnel without
tearing up
Howard Street, without stopping traffic on Howard Street?
Yes.
We had a caller who could not stay with us, and I don't remember every point that she wanted to make, but she was basically, with the trucking company, saying that they lose, I forget how many hours a week, she said, 80 to 100 hours a week lost in waiting time. And I know you already addressed, Craig and Joel called earlier, with the same issue. But it also raises the question, what is the port doing about the pollution from waiting trucks, the effect on air quality?
We've applied through the federal government for environmental money that's available to ports to help with a truck replacement program. And we've been pretty successful with that, where we work with Maryland Motor Truck to get the older equipment off the roads so newer, cleaner-burning trucks are coming into the terminal.
So you think you're having less impact than would have been true a couple of years ago?
Absolutely.
And is there any further improvement on the horizon?
Well, as long as the federal funding continues, we'll be able to offer that to Maryland Motor Truck for more truck replacements.
We need to take another quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Helen Delick Bentley. After her death, former Governor Robert Ehrlich wrote, "If you were on the wrong side of an issue, there was no tougher adversary. If you were an ambitious young green politician, there was no better mentor." So when we come back, we will remember Helen Delick Bentley. You can join that conversation, too, or you can continue to ask us questions or make comments about the port. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. Our phone number is 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. In 2006, in celebration of the Port of Baltimore's 300th birthday, it was renamed the Helen Delick Bentley Port of Baltimore. A congresswoman, reporter, advocate for port improvements, Helen Bentley died August 6th. She was 92 years old. I'm speaking with James White, executive director of the Maryland Port Administration. And joining us by phone is political Maryland commentator Barry Raskovar, who wrote a piece for MarylandReporter.com to remember Helen Bentley. Barry, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Sheila.
And let me just tell listeners, you can join this conversation, too. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. If you remember Helen Delick Bentley, do you remember reading her coverage of the port, or do you remember watching her TV show? What are your thoughts about her? Barry, your reminiscence of her was very fond. You worked with her as a journalist. What was she like in the newsroom?
She was pretty much like she was down on the docks.
Which
she
is?
Was, I guess you could call it, crusty but lovable. She was could be a very difficult person to work with. She could be profane. She was absolutely, totally dedicated to good journalism, to getting the story. She was also fanatical in her devotion to the Port of Baltimore.
Tell us the story of her as a journalist. I think people who first experienced her in public office, as a congresswoman, for example, most of us journalists don't turn out to do useful things in life. How did she start, and how did she go from being a journalist to being a public official?
Well, Helen Bentley's story is a marvelous one. It really is. She came to the Baltimore Sun in the mid-1940s, and within a year or two had finagled her way into a position that she would be reporting on maritime affairs, the Port of Baltimore. And she was literally the only woman journalist in the country, if not the world, doing this. You know, talk about women's lib. She was decades and decades ahead of her time. But, you know, as a journalist, she was just absolutely relentless to the point that within a matter of years, there wasn't an International Longshoremen's Union executive who didn't know Helen Bentley and was terrified not to take her phone calls. And at the same time, you know, Helen Bentley was someone who pushed and prodded and would do anything she could to make the Port of Baltimore better. Indeed, you know, she was one of the ones who was largely responsible for eliminating the Sun's reputation of being the port that did not work in the rain. And she did this by hammering hard at Longshoremen Union executives until they finally gave in on that point. And, you know, it was a real turnaround point for the port and really could not have happened had Bentley not applied that pressure.
But I'm trying to understand the relentless journalist becoming an advocate at a time when journalism wasn't usually advocacy journalism. Was there a point where she had to decide whether she was going to be an advocate or an observer?
Not in Helen's mind. No, she never saw the dividing line whatsoever. Indeed, you know, when the opportunity arose to go to Washington as the first female member of the Federal Maritime Commission, she not only went, she negotiated her way into a better job as the first female chairperson of the Federal Maritime Commission. And then, at that point, she was basically into politics. And she took on Representative Clarence Long, who was a real foe of expansion of the Port of Baltimore, and was dead set against taking dredged materials from the bottom of the harbor channel and dumping them at a place was then called Hart and Miller Islands. And this was a life or death struggle for the port if they did not have a place to deposit this sludge material. And Bentley was so enraged by the intransigence of Congressman Long that she ran against him as a Republican. And she ran not once, not twice, but three times. And the third time was the magic charm. And that was the full transition to politician Helen Bentley.
So she was elected, I believe, in 1980. How long was she in the House?
10 years.
10 years.
Ten years, and again, just an absolute relentless advocate for the maritime industry, for shipping, and also became really celebrated because she was such a colorful character. You know, she was vehemently opposed to the trade benefits that China had in this country. And at one point, she even took, I believe it was a made-in-China radio set and smashed it on the steps of Capitol Hill with all the photographers out there to watch the entertainment, so to speak. But, you know, she got her point across.
James White, we had talked earlier about dredging these days and the wetlands that the port creates by doing it, a different view of dredging than former Congressman Long had, apparently. So Helen Bentley was in Congress during the 80s. I don't know when you first would have come in contact with her or whether you have some memory of her around the port.
I've worked very closely with Helen. Matter of fact, I contribute the 50-foot channel to her. Without her involvement decades ago, we would have had a tremendous challenge today in getting 50 feet for the big ship. She got that obstacle out of the way decades ago because we were handling coal ships and we were handling steel ships going into Sparrows Point, and they needed the depth. And she fought for it. She got it. And we're still realizing those benefits today.
Did she keep in touch with the port?
Very much so. She was a consultant. You know, to sum up what Barry said, you know, she was either a tremendous asset or the devil.
That was actually what Governor Ehrlich said.
Oh, did he?
The quote that I read was from Governor Ehrlich. She was your best mentor or your worst enemy if you were on the other side.
If she was on your side, you knew that you stood a very good chance of winning. But if she was against you, you knew you were in it for a bloodbath.
Did you ever run up against her? Was there issue where you were on the other side? Tell us about it.
We had some mild differences of opinion over the years, healthy ones, the way the port should be developed. When I came to the port back in the mid-90s, the total focus was on being a container port. The vision of the team that was here at the Port Administration, as well as Helen, was it's all about containers. We got to get ready for containers. And, you know, we looked at our port. We knew we had limitations on the rail side. We looked at geography and where we were, and we molded that into a strategic plan where we had to convince our board, as well as Helen, that the best thing for us was to go after automobiles, farm equipment, because of the proximity of the port, the car manufacturers in the Midwest. We had a geographic advantage. And we changed that whole vision on where the port was heading. We changed it from being an all container port to being a more diversified port. And I think Helen, at the end, respected that and helped us with it. You know, she knew all the railroad carriers. She knew the container carriers. She got involved with our forest products business. And at the end, even the cruise business, she got involved. So I think she realized that it was the right direction for the port. And once she did, she was on board with it.
The cruise business. How long has the Port of Baltimore been involved with cruises?
We've been home porting ships now for – home porting ship means you have a ship every week. We've been home porting ships now for about 10 years. We just signed an extended agreement with Carnival and Royal that they'll be calling here for the next 5 years.
So about what proportion of the port's business is cargo versus cruise?
There's a lot of answers to that.
that was a pretty straightforward question.
On the economic side, how much does it produce versus other cargoes? How much acreage does it take? You know, because it's – I'm not sure how you want me to answer that.
I'll take the number. I'll take the
economic side?
The economics.
Well, it's great for the city of Baltimore because each ship that calls here – produces easily $1 million in benefit to the region. So if we have 100 ships a year, that's $100 million in benefit, and most of that goes to Baltimore City. Because when people are taking a cruise, if they're not Marylanders, they're probably staying overnight in a hotel. When they come back early, we find that they'll stay an extra few days in Maryland. They'll stay in a hotel. They'll go to the aquarium, the science center, they'll eat at the restaurants. So Baltimore City really gets the lion's share of the economic benefit on our cruise business.
Barry Raskovar of Political Maryland, before I let you go, I do want to ask you whether you have one Whether you as a journalist ever turned to Helen Delig Bentley to be a source, and how that went. What was it like working with her in that way?
Well, I think my relationship with Helen was a little bit unique because I was at that time working as a journalist for the Baltimore Sun, and she had a soft heart for Sun Papers journalists. But I'll tell you, Sheila, the one image that will never leave me is when I was just starting out in the business at the Sun Papers, working in the city room at a desk, and watching all of a sudden this little hurricane storm into the city room with this broad brim hat on. And just starts screaming at everybody around her. Helen had just come back from some meeting or event on the docks or at the port and wanted to write her story, and she had a staff there. And no matter what they had done in her absence, she tore it up and started all over again. But meanwhile, there was this just a ruckus that would take place in a corner of the city room with Helen Bentley at the center of it all. And you know, it was really something to behold. And what was really fascinating was, at the end of the day, she always produced a great story.
That's a great way to remember her, Barry. I appreciate your telling us your memories of Helen Delig Bentley. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ryan has called us from Baltimore. Ryan, can you ask your question in 20 seconds?
Yes, I wanted to know the address or to the union hall where I can go and fill out an application.
Ryan wants to find out where he can apply or learn about jobs at the port.
Well, longshoreman jobs, you should probably go to the Steamship Trade Association, they can tell you the locals and each jurisdiction that all the locals have. The union locals within the ILA.
Ryan, we will put some information on our website to answer your question about how to learn about jobs. Thanks. Thank you for calling. And James White, thank you for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James White is Executive Director of the Maryland Port Administration. I also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Full Service Market, with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Eddiesofrolandpark.com is their website. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. How do you take students performing in the bottom 25% of their class to walking across the stage at college graduation? The Baltimore nonprofit Thread seems to have the answer. We'll listen back to our conversation with members of Thread and the organization's co-founder. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.